From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Ollie Barrett. Welcome to Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. Just run into the studio at the last minute, believe it or not. Frantically doing stuff around the show. Just about made it this Tuesday. Welcome to the programme. Hope you've had a good old day. It's been a chilly one here in Manchester, but it's been bright and it's been dry, and that you can't beat. Looking forward to hearing from you. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Yeah, mad day.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yeah, truthfully even, I genuinely or generally edit right up till about 5 minutes before the beginning of the programme. But as the news was on, I was frantically editing a bit of audio, so I was. Nearly got caught out there. Although it doesn't matter, does it really? I suppose. Michael Rivero wings in for the first time in 2019 from Oahu in Hawaii. Lots to talk about with Michael. He joins me this hour. Don't miss him. And as usual, if you have something to say, tweet it to me and I will put it to him. We'll get all the latest from the US independent media, which we don't maybe do often enough. We'll do more of that this year on the programme. We're live on Fab Radio 2 here in Manchester, of course, triggerwarning.tv, and the show broadcasts on TuneIn Radio and richieallen.co.uk. My website, the homepage on the left-hand side, is a player, and the programme is playing round the clock on that player. So that's Tuesday's programme then. So in the second hour, I've got an extended report on what happened yesterday at Westminster in terms of the protesting. I covered it in the monologue yesterday, and I knew this would be a big story because it is a manufactured story by the UK's press. It's a manufactured story. It is news that they have deliberately created. Okay, Anna Soubry and Owen Jones and Kay Burley and all of that. And we might have a bit of fun with this in the second hour, but it's very serious as well. At least what is behind it, I think, is very, very serious. So we'll do that in the second hour. And we'll make that as interactive as possible. I will be asking for your comments on that as we go along. It is Tuesday, January 8th, 2019. I wonder, people born in the 1950s or 1960s, I wonder, do they sometimes muse and think, wow, 2019? Because if you were born in the 50s or 60s, you were in your 20s in the 70s and 80s. Would you ever have imagined that you'd see 2019? And if so, what sort of world did you think you'd be living in? I'm 44. I turned 44 a few days ago. And I do remember the 80s. And I remember films made in the 1980s looking at 2010 and 2015 science fiction films. And it often amuses me thinking what we thought, you know, would, what the world would be like in 2019, 2020. Anyway, where are you going with that one, Richie? Well, going to be doing something on that in the programme in the next couple of weeks. Now, here's a very interesting story for you. And I, along with others, of course, have covered and will cover child sex abuse, paedophile rings, international paedophile rings, and Westminster paedophile rings. Historically, often comes up on the programme. I have no doubt that it will come up again on the programme this year. Here's a story today that's been covered by everybody. It's about Michael Kit Carson, who's a former youth football coach and was due in court today to face charges, multiple charges, charges even, of historical sexual abuse of boys aged under 16. Now, the man was due in court this morning, right? No, he wasn't. He was due in court tomorrow, Wednesday. Let's get it right, Richie. He was due in court tomorrow, Wednesday. This is a well-known football coach called Michael Kit Carson, 75, due in court tomorrow, facing multiple charges of historical sexual abuse of boys aged under 16. Well, you won't believe it. He only went and died this morning. He crashed his car, his Mazda 3, into a tree near Bodisham on the A1303 this morning. Apparently, the police in Cambridgeshire have said there was no other car involved in the crash. It was just him, and he's dead. The judge, due to hear this case beginning tomorrow, and obviously was going to meet with Michael Carson, well, he's basically said the case is closed. 9:45 a.m. this morning, Michael Carson, driving a Mazda 3, left the road and crashed into a tree. What's going on? Let's hear from Lorna Shaddock. She's a Sky News reporter, and she's telling the tale, or at least what we know so far. Lorna Shaddock, Sky News.
That's right. Well, 75-year-old Mr. Carson had worked at various football clubs in the area, Norwich City, Cambridge United, Peterborough United. He was the academy director there for a number of years. But he had pleaded not guilty at Cambridge Crown Court to 12 counts of indecent assault and one count of inciting a child to engage in sexual activity. So that was at a case earlier on at Cambridge Crown Court. And Cambridge police say those allegations involved 11 victims, all of them boys under 16. So that trial was supposed to start at Peterborough Crown Court yesterday, Monday, involving those alleged incidents. But yesterday, the prosecution asked for the trial to be postponed for 24 hours. And we now know why, because this morning, the prosecution told the court details of this road traffic collision involving Mr. Carson's car, which did result, they say, in his death. He had a red Mazda 3 car that left the road, went into a tree about 7 miles east of Cambridge on Monday morning. In fact, about 15 minutes before that trial was due to get underway. Now, emergency services were on the scene pretty quickly. They did do their best to save his life, but he was declared dead at the scene. And police are now asking people to get in touch if they were in the area at the time and have any more information or any dash cam footage of what has happened. But in the meantime, the judge at Peterborough Crown Court has now ruled that case be closed.
Yeah, case closed. In fact, I was right the first time. This happened the day before yesterday. I got a bit muddled there. He was due in court yesterday morning. How interesting this is. Case is closed, according to the judge. You've got to ask the question, because no reporter working in the media in this country will have the courage to ask the question, was it sabotage? Was this man's car run off the road, perchance? Was a group of people worried about what might emerge in open court, because this guy was pleading not guilty? Was he part of a paedophile ring? Who knows? We won't ever find out now. But it's very, very suspicious, isn't it? No other cars involved. His car left the road, drove off a motorway, National Road, A1303, whatever the road is, I think the National Road. So he's driven into a tree and he's dead. Greville Janner, dead. Mysteriously. A few weeks before he died of illness, he was popping into the House of Lords to collect his money. Leon Britton, dead. 2015, former Home Secretary. No mention at all that such a prestigious and famous former politician was suffering with cancer. No mention. It had never been mentioned in the press before we were told that he died of cancer. How convenient that was. When a number of different police forces wanted to speak to Leon Britton about the Dickens dossier and what Britton knew. Britton would, of course, no doubt today be investigated or be questioned, not investigated, as part of the historic child sex abuse inquiry. Dead. Suddenly dead in 2015. This man was alleged to have abused boys under the age of 16 between 1978 and 2009. He worked around Norwich Football Club. He worked around Cambridgeshire. He was very well known. I suppose those who knew him or know him or knew him would say, well, we believe that he was innocent all along. We're not going to find out now. But those are very mysterious circumstances for somebody to die. Somebody who held very prominent and very prestigious role within football, was very much involved with the Football Association and intimately knew people at the Football Association, still working there today. No suggestion any of these people ever did anything wrong, it must be said. But some of the people whom Carson knew, very high up in the FA and responsible for recruitment in terms of appointing England managers. I suggest the death of this guy is very convenient for somebody. But I don't know, I can't prove that. But I'm saying it anyway. 13 minutes past the hour. The Brexit Secretary, Stephen Barclay, has been speaking today to try and allay fears or assuage fears that Article 50 will be extended because of the mess that is Theresa May's attempt to get her Brexit withdrawal bill through Parliament. This is going to be voted on next Tuesday. The deal that Theresa May reached with the European Union will be voted on by members of Parliament next week. At least until today, anyway, it is or was believed that it had no chance. Some political commentators are saying that May's chances, May's prospects of getting this deal through Parliament are, in fact, improving as this particular week goes on. I don't know. The odds are against it anyway, triggering fears that when it is voted down, if it is voted down next week, that there will be a move to extend Article 50, which the European Union is saying the United Kingdom cannot do unilaterally. It must get the support of the other members, the other nation states whom are members of the European Union. Barclay said the Brexit Secretary, the third Brexit Secretary, by the way, that the UK remained committed to leaving on the 29th of March. But the spectre of delaying Article 50 or extending it has been raised a number of times in the last couple of days. Have a listen to the Digital Minister, Margot James, suggesting to the BBC yesterday that Article 50 might just have to be extended in order to stop a no-deal Brexit if May's deal is rejected by Parliament. Margot James speaking to the BBC yesterday.
If that proves to be impossible, then I think we have very little time left, we might have to extend Article 50, but I think it's very unlikely that Parliament will actually stare down the barrel of that particular gun, and I think it's far more likely that Parliament will get behind the deal.
Margot James, watch this space, I suppose. The BBC's Brussels reporter Adam Fleming had been telling the BBC yesterday, had been supplying reports back to the studio saying that Article 50 was the default backup plan for the European Union if MPs didn't agree to the Brexit deal. We'll find out next Tuesday anyway. You know what I think? I won't labour the point. I've said it 1,000 times. The UK will never leave the European Union. A couple of interesting and quirky stories in the press today. Here's one from The Independent. Prisoner of my tastes, French author defends remarks about women over 50. This is another one of these Twitter storms. One of those things I talked about in a live stream I made yesterday on YouTube, which is on YouTube. This is a guy called Jan. I don't know how to pronounce his surname. It's spelled M-O-I-X, so I'm presuming it's Mois. I don't know how to pronounce it. Let's say Yann Mois, right? Anyway, this guy is an author, and he has been speaking out today to say that he doesn't feel the need to apologise for speaking on television and saying that he was personally incapable of loving women in their 1950s. What's wrong with me today? In their 1950s. That would make them very old. He said he doesn't feel the need to apologise for telling an interviewer that he couldn't love women whom are in their 50s. He's a television presenter in France, and he claimed he couldn't love any woman over the age of 50, said he has no regrets over those remarks, which have caused widespread outrage. He's 50 himself, by the way. He's promoting his latest book, which might explain the controversy. This could be just a brilliant bit of publicity by him and his publishing company. But interesting is the backlash that has grown up in France. He gave an interview to Marie Claire magazine. He said he couldn't love women in their 50s because they were too old. Twitter storm erupted. It went viral. Women all over the world were coming out saying that he was a misogynist, that he hated women and all the rest of it. Very interesting. Very interesting. Now, remember The Railway Children. I'm going somewhere with this. You might remember the film The Railway Children. If you did see The Railway Children, you'll remember Jenny Agutter, who's a very good actress, I think, Jenny Agutter. She's in very many things over the years. I think she's in a show on the BBC now that's very popular about midwives. Is that right? Am I right in saying that? Still very good. Still working is the actress Jenny Agutter. Well, she's getting Twitter storm now because according to a number of newspapers in the UK today, she's been speaking out about, not against, but about the hashtag MeToo movement. And according to the Daily Mail, she's berated the victims of abuse for putting themselves in vulnerable situations in the first place. Jenny Agutter, who's now 66, she's looking well, said that she can't fully understand why young actresses would meet with senior film industry figures alone, unless they found those senior film industry figures attractive. Why would you meet with these people on your own unless you found them attractive? So she's quoted as saying, "I can never fully understand the people who get themselves into problems. In the States, there are occasions when you might be asked to go to a private screening or someone's place and you just didn't do it unless you found the person very attractive, in which case you did do it." She told this to the Radio Times. But if they're not really attractive, there's nothing to be gained from it because it's obvious what you're indicating by going. Jenny Agutter there. A number of these Me Too bigwigs have been going after her on social media. I'm not sure she's on social media, saying that this is victim blaming. Of course, it's not victim blaming. It's a bloody good point. What are you doing going to these fat old men's houses? Unless it's to advance your career. Right? That's what she's saying. That's not to condone the likes of sleazeballs like Harvey Weinstein, of course. And again, we've got to keep saying this now, not virtue signalling at all. Not to condone the behaviour of lecherous, fumbling morons like Weinstein, but why would you put yourself into position is the question Jenny Agutter is gently probing today. I think it's a good question in the current climate. 21 minutes past the hour. This might make you fall off your chair. With laughter, it might not. The Antichrist is going to control mankind through gadgets and through the internet as people fall into slavery to smartphones. Who said that? The Pope? No. The Archbishop of Canterbury? No. I'll tell you who said it. The leader of Russia's Orthodox Church. Somebody called Patriarch Kirill. That's what they're called. If you're the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, you are called Patriarch something. This guy is Patriarch Kirill. It's not his real name. He's the top man in the Russian Church. And he says the Antichrist is going to control mankind through gadgets and the internet and slavery to smartphones. I like the sound of this guy. He's 72. He said he doesn't entirely oppose smartphones, but he warned against falling into slavery of them. Orthodox Christians celebrate Christmas Day on the 7th of January, which was yesterday, and Patriarch Kirill made these comments during a holiday message broadcast yesterday. He spoke on the state-run Russia 1 TV network. The Antichrist is a personality that will be at the head of the World Wide Web controlling the entire human race. Thus, the structure itself presents a danger, said the man of God, because that's what he is. And I'm really interested in this because very good friends of mine who are more spiritual than me, they would be very interested in hearing what this man is saying. But according to the Telegraph newspaper and the Daily Mail today, in the past, Vladimir Mikhailovich, which is his real name, the head of the Orthodox Church, has said things like, for example, the rise of ISIS is partly the result of the world accepting homosexuality.
What kind of fuckery is this?
He was doing so well with Satan and the mobile phones. I was interested. And then he said that ISIS grew up because people are fed up of people accepting homosexuality. He claimed that Muslims were fleeing to join ISIS and Iraq to avoid being part of a civilization that holds events like gay pride. He was doing so well. Shall we get my guest this hour on the programme, shall we? I'm just saying a quick hello to him there. Let's see. We'll give him 2 minutes to get ready. Michael Rivero is winging in, as I said earlier, from Hawaii for the first time in 2019. Looking forward to speaking with Michael. Love having him on the programme. Tweets to him and for him can be directed to me through at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. A number of you have been tweeting about 2019 and being born in the 50s and 60s. Big shout out to Liz Jones, by the way. How you doing, Liz? Nice to know you're listening to the programme today. Right, going to have a tune. Going to have a bit of a tune. This is New Order and Blue Monday on the Richie Allen Show on Tuesday. Doesn't make much sense, I suppose. Lots to talk about with Michael Rivero. And in the second hour, an extended report on the furore over the treatment of Anna Soubry, former government minister, now a backbencher, whom was called Nazi and was followed into Westminster yesterday afternoon and was spoken to by protesters. Massive story created by the mainstream media. Mining stories is what they're doing. Going to talk about that a bit later on. Before that, New Order, Blue Monday. Keep your tweets coming in. Lots of them already. Back in a couple of minutes with Mike. Sure, I went and played the extended version like an absolute plonker, didn't I? So I might as well get rid of it now because it goes on for about 14 hours and 26 minutes. The extended version of New Order's Blue Monday. Let's welcome to the show for the first time this year. We didn't catch up with him in December. Got away from us December as we approached Christmas. But he's a great journalist and broadcaster and I've known him for a long time. Been coming on my programmes since my Spain days. You can catch him at the What Really Happened radio show. Terrific show. And the website, whatreallyhappened.com, is packed daily. It's packed full of information, links to information and evidence that isn't presented on the mainstream media. It's always a pleasure to welcome to the show my friend Michael Rivero. Michael, aloha and happy new year to you. How are you?
I'm fine. Aloha and happy new year to you as well.
Thanks for coming on, Mike. Bright and early there in Oahu. Just before we talk about Trump and the shutdown and all the madness of all that, you, of course, have a wonderful career, varied and diverse career, working in films, of course, and special effects and television. I was looking, today it occurred to me, 2019. Now, I know it's common for people to think about, you know, as the years go on, 2019, wow. I was thinking today, what must people born in the 50s, 60s or 70s, I was born in the very early 70s, what must they make of 2019? And what did they think back in their 20s and 30s, you know, the 2000s would be like and 2020, 2019 would be like? Is the reality now, Michael, in terms of the technological reality, where we are technologically, where we are as a community, as a society, is it different to what you imagined it would have been like? Because you often had to imagine as a special effects creator what the future would look like. What's it like, Michael, compared to what you thought it might be like?
Well, from the technological point of view, it's very much what everybody thought it was going to be. In fact, sometimes being the age that I am and having grown up with the early days of computers, sometimes the new technology still fills me with awe. For the younger generation, of course, it's what they're used to. It's what they've always known. So they're perhaps not as excited about it as I am. But for example, I got myself a little Raspberry Pi computer. And the idea that all this computational power and storage is on this one little card is a stunner to me. When the first computer I ever worked on was an IBM 1130, which was the size of an office desk plus a refrigerator plus an oven. And nowhere near as powerful. So it's a little stunning for me. Politically, of course, when I was in my youth, growing up in New England, I never, ever, ever dreamt I would see our nation go the way it has gone politically, turn into an aggressor nation, slide down the road toward fascism, seeing open attacks on our Bill of Rights, and it's very upsetting.
We're going to talk about that, of course, in a couple of minutes. On the technology, Michael,
yes,
is the technology a Trojan horse? Is the technology, while wonderful, when you open the front page story of the technology is, wow, wonderful, helps us do things that much quicker, can be helpful to people in so many different ways, health-wise, logistical and all of that. But is it a bit of a Trojan horse, Michael? Do we need to see beyond wow? Do we need to see beyond that and maybe that the technology is kind of enslaving rather than emancipating?
Well, technology is a tool like any other tool. It can be used for good purposes or bad purposes. You can take a hammer and use it to repair the siding on your house, or you can bash somebody's head in with it. The same argument holds true for firearms. You can use it to protect your home, put food on the table, or target shoot for fun, or you can do harm with it. The same thing with technology. There's a light side and a dark side, and unfortunately, those who are manufacturing and controlling the technology will seek to use it to their advantage rather than our own. And so you have to be very careful how much of that technology you want to have. For example, Claire and I will not have one of those voice assistants in our home because they're always listening. And yeah, it's not like we have anything to hide because all of our political opinions are out there on the website and the radio show. But by nature, we are private people. And I don't like the idea that somebody somewhere is tracking everywhere I go. It's none of Google's business if I stop off at the bake shop on the way home and have a jelly donut. And so I tend to pull back from a lot of that kind of technology. It's fun to play with and find positive uses with. But again, like any other tool, people with nefarious intentions can do evil with it, as we see with all this out of control cyber crime and cyber warfare, there are a lot of bad people out there.
No doubt, Michael. No doubt. I want to ask you about this government shutdown. I was asked to put this to you today. No better man than you to put it into context and explain it. To me, it's theatre. It doesn't matter. It's just more manufactured drama to keep people watching and arguing. You probably will take a different take, which is no bad thing. What does it mean, Michael, that the government shuts down? How can a government shut down?
Well, it's a partial government shutdown. And what it really means is they're shutting down the parts of the government we, the people, really like to have, like, clean national parks and monuments and things that we like to go to and so forth. The parts of the government we don't approve of, like the wars, they're still going strong. And a lot of it is drama. And right now what we're seeing is a power play between Donald Trump in the White House and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in the Congress to see who's really running the country. And what was very alarming is about a week ago, after she became Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi was in an interview in the New York Times in which she actually came out and said the Constitution makes her the equal of the president, which is complete and utter nonsense. But it does tell you what's going on here. It's basically Trump is proving to be a weak leader. There's a power vacuum, and others are stepping on in to fill that power vacuum. And that includes Pelosi, Schumer, certainly John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, who succeeded in completely reversing Trump's Syria withdrawal policy. We have a badly factionalized and very unstable government where from day to day, nobody's really sure who's really ultimately calling the shots.
This troop withdrawal, let's stay with that because it's very important. Look, all I can say is what I've said before, but it doesn't mean I'm right or making me right. I don't believe in Donald Trump. I've never believed in him at all or believed that he was authentic. He might be authentic in his mind, he might be genuine, but I've always believed, and I said even when he was running, that he was as controlled as anybody else. I never believed that there was any danger that the United States would withdraw troops from Syria or anywhere else in the Middle East. What's really going on here? Is Trump, you know, trying to... Is Trump trying to signal to his base that, look, well, I'm doing my best and I'm trying to fulfil these campaign promises, but I just can't do it? And if that is what Trump is doing, well, it just proves how worthless government and the office of president is anyway, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. You know, Trump has had 2 years to put on those presidential brass knuckles and start carrying out his campaign promises, and he's not doing it. He dropped the ball on vaccine safety. He's dropped the ball on overhauling our election system. While he has not started any new wars, he certainly has not succeeded in pulling us out of any of the ones we're already in. He's surrounded himself by hardcore neocon advisors who are the same ones who got us into this war mess all the way back in the Bush administration. So while I don't think Trump was being intentionally deceptive, he is proving himself to be a weak leader. He's easily manipulated. He's susceptible to flattery. He is alienating his own political base. He didn't even stick up for the independent media when it came under attack by Google and Twitter and Facebook. And either he has forgotten or never really cared. The independent media worked very hard to get him into that Oval Office, not so much because we liked him as much as we didn't want Hillary Clinton there. And so, but it does illustrate that it almost seems like it doesn't matter who's in that Oval Office, that deep state war machine is moving on, and we're edging closer and closer to World War III and the possibility of a nuclear conflict.
Let's talk about that in a second, right? World War III, and this year, it's interesting that the UK government, various ministers have acknowledged this week to various publications that they accept that Bashar al-Assad is going to be in power in Syria for the foreseeable future. It's lovely to hear them say that through gritted teeth. You know, God love them. They've done their absolute best to turn Syria, and have succeeded in so many places in Syria, to turn it into a kind of a beyond Thunderdome reality. They've levelled the country. But the rightful leader, whatever you might think about autocratic governments, he's the rightful leader for the time being, and it's right and proper that he should be there. We'll talk about World War III in a minute. Michael, I came to this conclusion. You're a very smart man, Michael, and we've been doing radio shows too long for me to patronise you. I believe you're very smart, you're very quick, you know, most likely a smarter man than I am. I came to the conclusion years ago that it has never mattered in my lifetime, and will never matter, who is in charge in any particular country, because the choices of leaders given to us are given to us by these financial and global elites. It doesn't matter. It matters not whether Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders gets in, or Obama or whomever, because ultimately they have to answer to the money men. That's what it is. I believe Kennedy was murdered because, amongst other things he was doing, he was looking at that situation, that Fed system. So it just doesn't matter, Michael. Do you think more people will, through their horrible disappointment at what Trump has proven to be, will start to understand that the system itself has to go, not the people within the system? Over to you.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And of course, I'm not encouraging anybody to have any kind of an uprising, although we're starting to see protests all over the world in all these countries, not just the Yellow Vest protests, but this push to create a global government has created a political environment conducive to a global revolution. And I keep advising my listeners and readers, this government of the United States of America seems to be on the same path toward collapse as the former Soviet Union. And the task before us is to be ready, first of all, to weather the storm when that central government falls, because it has worked very hard to get us all dependent on it. And we're going to have to work very hard to be able to survive without that dependency. And then after that, put together a new nation and going on back to our original constitutional system and the first 13 amendments, I think, is a good way to start, because the way the United States was originally started, there were strict limits on how much money any one individual could give to any candidate or campaign. And that was to prevent the ultra wealthy from simply buying the government. But unfortunately, over the intervening centuries, the wealthy have chipped away at the integrity of our central government. Until now, the Capitol building is basically a giant shopping mall for the special interests.
Michael Rivero is our guest. Check out whatreallyhappened.com and the What Really Happened radio show if you haven't before. You can follow Michael on Twitter. It's at @WRH_Rivero. That's at @WRH_Rivero on Twitter. Michael, do you think that, just to clarify what you said a minute ago, do you think that there will be a continual push in 2019 towards a global conflict, or are you saying that you think a global conflict is inevitable? The reason I say that is because it alarms people. You don't do fear porn. It's not in your remit. World War III, Michael, terrifies people, the prospect.
Well, it should. It absolutely should. And one of the things that concerns me is how many people are glibly talking about the potential for a nuclear war. And our generation, of course, never actually got to see nuclear bombs in real life. To us, it's an abstraction in video games or TV or movie, and we don't really comprehend just how insanely powerful these weapons are. And I've had some conversations with people who live with us here on the island of Oahu in Hawaii, and I tell them, do you really grasp the fact that just one Chinese nuclear weapon can melt this entire island down into glass? And it's like they just can't get their heads around just how insanely powerful these weapons are. Now, I know from the point of view of the military-industrial complex, what they want is a new Cold War, like we had back in the 1950s and the 1960s, which was basically a gigantic swindle. The corporate media and the government and the military contractors would wave, you know, commies at the American people, who would then surrender all of their money and their children for proxy wars. But the big war was never to be fought, although unfortunately we came very, very close on a couple occasions. There was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Then there were actually, and a lot of people don't know this, there were a couple of accidental situations that almost led to the release of nuclear weapons. And today, the situation is much more complicated because so many of our weapon systems are now computerized and they operate so quick, humans can't intervene. And that was what happened in the case of the USS Vincennes shooting down that Iranian passenger jetliner. It was a software error, and the passenger jetliner was killed before somebody could hit the override button. Same thing with TWA 800, which was accidentally shot down during a test of the Aegis CEC system. These computerized weapons operate so fast, if they make a mistake, there's no taking it back. And that could take a Cold War and turn it hot very, very quickly.
Here's a question on that. I Googled the term AI, which everybody knows means artificial intelligence. I Googled it yesterday, and there was, I couldn't believe, there was an avalanche of stories in the global media about artificial intelligence in 2019. I know there's an agenda to use artificial intelligence in defensive situations, or even to put artificial intelligence programs, if I can use that, I don't know if we should call them programs, artificial intelligence beings or whatever, in charge of the release of weapons, or put them into active warfare situations. Is that a concern in the future? Do we often see life imitating art, Michael? I know you've been asked this before about the Terminator scenario, James Cameron. Is that a real possibility in the future?
Well, it certainly is. They're already talking about, you know, completely autonomous drones that are weaponized and able to kill. And to really understand the implications of AI in the battlefield, we need to clarify our definitions. Most people, when they think of AI, they think of HAL 9000 or Vicky or something that seems human-like or at least sentient and self-aware. That's called general AI, and that is still a long way off. AI today within the computer industry simply means any software that is able to learn and adapt its program to a situation. And most of them are very narrow case situations. Companies are selling AI systems that have to be trained before they can be used. And a good example would be IBM's Watson, which is incorporated into the Weather Channel's weather forecasting system. But to judge just from here in Hawaii, the forecasts are worse than we used to get with our human meteorologists. And so it raises the possibility. How do we know what the AI is learning is correct? Because it's learning and judging and changing so rapidly. It's not like there's an AI teacher or an AI school looking over their shoulder to make sure that what they're doing is right. And there have been some experiments with AI that have produced some very bizarre and disturbing results in terms of evolving their own language or coming on out with just expressions of extreme anger. So there definitely is a danger there. I don't think we really understand what these systems are capable of doing. And we ought not to be throwing them into the weapon systems. But it's the new buzz term. And apparently, you know, the Consumer Electronics Show, AI is the big buzzword along with quantum computing. And it's a marketing term. And they're throwing it on out there and selling product, which may be flawed. And you need to understand that in the United States of America, software makers are in fact indemnified from lawsuits for defective products, going back to the days of the Apple II and the Commodore 64, when computers were a fledgling industry and it was felt they needed protection. But today,
Michael, hang on, Michael. As usual, my great friend, you've educated me. I didn't know this.
Okay.
Let me just ask you to repeat that again. Way back in the day, software was protected because it was a fledgling industry, protected against lawsuits in the future if the software caused harm. Is that right?
That's right. Along with the computers themselves, the hardware itself. You know, the whole new microcomputer industry. Congress passed a law saying they were indemnified against product liability.
Wow.
And so basically what it means is if you're running a small business and you buy a truck and the truck, because of a design flaw, crashes and you suffer financial harm, you can sue the manufacturer of the truck for your damages. But if you buy a computer accounting system for your business and because of a design flaw, it crashes and you suffer financial harm, you are stuck. Most people really don't take the time to read those end-user license agreements that are plastered all over the computers and software. They really ought to, because it basically says, we can sell you whatever we want to sell you. We can do whatever we want to your machine, and you have really no choice about it. So with that cavalier attitude toward the quality of computer software, and go on out and listen to all the complaints about Windows 10 as one example. Now, all of a sudden, you're taking the next generation of this software, AI, self-learning, self-adjusting software, and you're attaching it to things that can kill large numbers of people. To me, yes, that's an area of concern.
Massive concern, isn't it?
Yes. I mean,
you've covered that very well. You've been very objective there. I mean, at the beginning, you said that the Terminator-type AIs, you're not sure that they're around. You think they might be years off. What if they're not years off, Michael? They're great at keeping secrets. I have a question here from a great friend of mine, Jean Ann Crowley, who's listening to this on the west coast of Ireland as we speak. And she asks, Michael, how technically far ahead do you think the deep state is, or the military industrial complex, or whatever we call them? I bet, says Jean Ann, they have weapons like lasers and probably even spookier ones that might be manned by AI already. We just wouldn't know. So how technically advanced could they be, Michael, without our knowledge?
Well, back again at the height of the Cold War, it was understood that the military tried to keep themselves at least 20 years ahead of civilian technology. But over the course of the Moon program and subsequent years, that gap has somewhat narrowed as the military reaches more and more out into the civilian and university environment for R&D. And I would say right now they may be 5 to 10 years ahead. But as far as a Terminator-type machine, again, they are working on autonomous hunter-killer drones. I mean, James Cameron was right about that one. As far as machines that can walk around shooting people, some of the stuff coming out of Boston Dynamics is absolutely amazing. Although for the moment, they're saying it's just to carry stuff for the troops. But again, when drones first showed up, they said they're just for surveillance, and now they're carrying missiles and guns.
Amazing, Michael, isn't it? what we might
terrifying.
Not, terrifying, absolutely terrifying. Michael Rivero is our guest. Michael is going to stay with me till the top of the hour. At least I hope you are, Mike. There's a couple of other things. Great to have you on. WhatReallyHappened.com. I know you've heard of Michael Rivero, but as we get a lot of people accessing this programme through Fab Radio, commercial radio here in Manchester, and they are new to the independent media, you might not have heard of Michael. So go to WhatReallyHappened.com and check him out. Fascinated by what you thought, Michael, about this crazy drone story that we had here in the UK. Amazing story. Shut down Gatwick Airport over the Christmas. Unbelievable chaos. We don't know whether there even was a drone there or not, Michael. But what we have seen is we've seen legislation introduced that would make it easy for the state to shut down other people's drones. Do you smell classic problem reaction solution here?
Well, I think they're taking advantage of the situation. Drones are certainly under attack here in the United States. The government wants to have control of the low-level skies. And there are, unfortunately have been people who've been very irresponsible with their drones, which are exacerbating the situation. As far as Gatwick is concerned, the last report I heard is that somebody spotted one of the police's observation drones and hit the panic button. So there wasn't really an outside drone trying to cause problems, just everybody overreacted. But I'm in agreement with those who say there should be areas where drones are not allowed to go, and certainly near airports are definitely one of them. In the end, I think what we're probably going to see is drones are going to be treated the way model rocketry is, which it's confined to certain set-aside recreational areas. I think that's pretty good. Now, obviously, there should be exceptions. Drones are very useful for film and television work. They're much less expensive and much more useful than conventional camera cranes. But I think just for people who want to go around and play with a drone, unless it's one that is small enough to fit inside their home, I think going on out to a park or going on out somewhere where they're not going to crash into somebody's home is a really good thing. But as far as banning drones outright, right now, the capabilities of the drones available to consumers, just I don't think they really represent that much of a threat to the deep state. At the point where they do, then, yeah, I would imagine there'd be a real push to say you can't have those.
I'm going to argue. I love having an argument with you, my old friend. I'm going to have an argument with you now, Mike. I don't know about that. I think you and I have spoken often about very dodgy and very dubious shootings that we have suspected. What I love about you is you'll say, look, there are anomalies here, but I can't say for sure. We see shootings and they're blamed on a third party. And often then what follows that shooting is draconian legislation, more surveillance, more, you know, destruction of posse comitatus. We see all that. I wonder, you see, because more and more people have drones, I wonder if the establishment or the deep state worries that next time they say there's a shooting or a stabbing on Westminster Bridge, maybe they don't want Michael Rivero or Richie Allen sending a little drone up in the sky to have a look at it, Michael. Because of what we might see.
You have a good point.
Yeah. You know, so I look at that Gatwick thing and I put my tinfoil hat on, Mike, and I think that smacks there now of a situation engineered in order to give the state more control over drones. But maybe I'm being a bit conspiratorial.
Well, here in the United States, there's already over at the FAA, drones above a certain size and capability have to be registered like aircraft. And they're now subject to certain regulations as to where they can go. The low-end consumer drone, like we saw being given out at Christmas, they just don't have the range and altitude to be of concern. But the larger ones that I was talking about that are useful for film and television, the ones that are powerful enough to carry a camera, a high-quality camera, those actually have to get a license.
Michael, finally, thanks for coming back on today. We look forward to having you on this year in 2019. WhatReallyHappened.com. Folks, Michael's website. I wanted to ask you finally this hour, Mike, about a couple of, well, one particular, the midterm elections threw up some interesting results. One of them was a woman whom I think was featured in Michael Moore's documentary, Fahrenheit 11-9. Now, I've got to put a caveat on this. I've no time for Michael Moore. He lost all his credibility when he stitched up Charlton Heston when he made Bowling for Columbine, which was otherwise a decent film, but he stitched up old Charlton and the NRA,
yes,
which was a disgrace. And when you do that, you lose trust forever. Moore is very subdued in this latest Fahrenheit 11.9 film, very subdued by his own standards. But he does feature a couple of people. And I think he featured, and I might be wrong, the congresswoman before she became congresswoman, Rashida Tlaib. I think that's how you pronounce it. She's in Congress, and there's been a lot of talk about her in the papers recently about putting a map of Palestine in her office. Who is this woman, Michael? What do we make of her?
Well, we're still finding out about her. I haven't seen any Michael Moore movie since Who Are We to Invade Next?
Yeah.
And it's kind of frustrating with Michael Moore because, you know, every once in a while he comes out with a brilliant film and then he surrounds him with this liberal nonsense gun grabber, whatever. But I haven't seen 11.9. As far as this lady is concerned, they're trying to portray her as a rising star. They're trying to portray her as a supporter of Palestine in an otherwise pro-Israel Congress. But if you look back at her profile from 2008, you find out that she got a lot of support from Jewish interests in launching her career. So more and more people are starting to think that she may be some kind of a Trojan horse. We'll know from looking at her voting record.
Yeah, we'll watch that one closely. Hey, just before we go, Mike, you're not going to believe this. You're not going to believe it, Mike. This is an and finally to beat all and finallys. Departures at Heathrow Airport have been stopped in the last 5 minutes, Michael. The busiest airport in the world because of a drone sighting. As we've been on air. Honest to God, you couldn't make it up, could you? That's just breaking, no. So I can't say any more about it. The BBC reporting right now, as I'm speaking with Michael Rivero, the departures at Heathrow Airport have been stopped after a drone sighting. A spokeswoman said the police is involved and there are efforts to prevent any threat to operational safety. Wow, Mike. There's something more to this.
I think you were right and I was wrong on that one.
Well, maybe maybe it's
starting to feel like, this is enough to outlaw drones.
How interesting. Mate, it was brilliant to catch up with you. Do pass on our best wishes for 2019 to your wife, Claire. Thanks for making your radio shows, my friend, and for updating whatreallyhappened.com on a daily basis. It wouldn't be as easy to do my job without you doing your job. I promise you that. Happy New Year, Mike. Thanks for coming on. Speak in February.
You got it. Look forward to it. Happy New Year to you.
Cheers, Michael. The brilliant Michael Rivero, live on the line from Oahu in Hawaii. What an amazing thing that is, speaking to Michael about drones there. And it's just been announced, or reported, I should say, by the BBC, that departures at Heathrow Airport have been suspended after a drone sighting. Can't tell you any more about that because it's a breaking news story. Wow. As it stands, the law around drones and using them near airports is there is a 1 kilometre exclusion zone. Of course, we talked a bit about this, didn't we? Just before Christmas. A 1 kilometre exclusion zone, that always felt a bit close to me, to be fair. Anybody who runs or walks regularly every day, 5 kilometres, 6 kilometres, you know what a kilometre is. And you know that a kilometre is not a great distance at all. And I think the proximity of drones. And my friend Gene Ann has been talking to me about the Israeli interests. And, well, she's not been talking to me about it, but she did say there has been news and there have been reports, of course, about the use of drones made in Israel, but also the use of security. And let me just go and scroll up there. The provision of security for UK airports by Israeli firms, which I know has come up in the past. How interesting. It is 2.5 minutes to the top of the hour. That's 2.5 minutes to six. This is the Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2, richieallen.co.uk, triggerwarning.tv, and TuneIn Radio as well. Speaking of Morrissey, we weren't speaking of Morrissey. I like a bit of melodrama with my music. This is Morrissey and Hold On To Your Friends from Vauxhall and I, which for me is his greatest album and thus one of the greatest albums of all time. Proper tune this, back in a minute with plenty more on your Richie Allen Show. Yeah, Morrissey, Hold On To Your Friends. That's not a bad bit of advice that. Hold on to your friends. Don't fall out with your friends. Not over politics anyway. Thanks, Jean Anne. Yes, reported by the Associated Press back on Christmas Day that an Israeli anti-drone company has seen a massive spike in interest after the Gatwick drama, when the drone basically halted traffic at Gatwick Airport for 36 hours. Thanks for that link, Jean Anne. Number of you pointing me to similar stories and similar links on Twitter as well. Good evening to you, by the way. To Ricky, to Paul, to Faisal, to Busy, to Gail, to Andrew Bell. Andrew says, Richie, I sent that drone up for you, Richie. Was the timing? It was brilliant, brilliant timing, Andrew. Thank you. Quality bit of production there by Andrew Bell. He's the man responsible for the Heathrow drone. So look, this is a developing thing, and I'm going to take a different turn now on the programme and not talk so much about drones. But outbound traffic stopped at Heathrow Airport. The breaking story at 2 minutes past six on Tuesday, January 8th, 2019. Michael came around to my way of thinking at the end there. I think there might be something going on, Richie. There might be. But you could fit what I don't know. What I don't know. In 500 blank Bibles. There's so much that I don't know. But there you are. Right, we're going to take a slightly different turn now. We're going to talk about Anna Soubry in a minute. But before we talk about Anna Soubry, fascinating story. I like when, you know, I won't say I like because it's not nice. Things are happening now that are not nice. They're not good. They're not good for people. But also, in one sense, when things are happening and you see news stories that confirm a suspicion that you had, you know, you feel relieved, I think, sometimes. A little bit of relief. You think, well, I wasn't crazy. I wasn't crazy. I came across a story today on Sky News, and I was lucky to grab it because I don't often listen to Ian King, even though I like Ian King. He's a good presenter. He's a nice chap. He broadcasts from the Gherkin. Ian King live for Sky twice a day live. Sky's daily business show, Ian King. And he had a breaking news story today about digital banking, which is very important. And it's an interesting story because in amongst Brexit, in amongst the Anna Soubry harassment at Westminster story, Owen Jones, Kay Burley, in amongst all of that, this story will just get completely lost. And it's a massive story. And this is what happens in the news media. Here's a breaking news story from Ian King about the digital bank Monzo. What is a digital bank? Well, let's hear the breaking story anyway. This was the report from Ian King today.
Well, some breaking news now, and live to our city editor Mark Lyman, who's in our central London studio. Mark, I gather you got some breaking news on the challenger bank sector.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. It's the start of a big year for the UK's digital banks, with the likes of Revolut, Atom Bank, Starling and N26 all likely to seek fresh funding. Well, I can reveal today that another Monzo is turning to one of Britain's most experienced bankers to help steer it through the next few years of what it hopes will be spectacular growth. Now, Gary Hoffman, who was parachuted in to run Northern Rock during its emergency nationalisation in the financial crisis, will be named tomorrow as Monzo's new chairman. Monzo's not a tiny company at this stage, Ian, to be clear. It was only set up 4 years ago and gained its banking licence in 2017. But already it's got more than 1 million current account holders. It's set a target of growing that to 3 million during the course of 2019. And when it raised £85 million of new funding from investors recently, that valued Monzo at more than £1 billion. Now, Mr. Hoffman's appointment as its chairman is interesting for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it indicates where a seasoned banker like him believes the industry's growth is going to come from in the next few years. But I think it also reflects the fact that banking regulators are keen to see this breed of fast-growing digital lenders beef up their boards in terms of banking expertise. We've seen what happened in recent years with banks' IT systems failing and the broader payment systems problems and what happens, the chaos that ensues as a result. And I think the appointment of someone like Mr. Hoffman, a former Barclaycard chief executive, former Barclays vice chairman, to the board of Monzo illustrates the fact that this fast-growing digital banking industry is having to grow up very quickly.
This is mind-bending stuff, what he just said there. This is a guy called Kleinman. He's the reporter, Kleinman. He's talking about the digital bank Monzo, which has gained a million current account holders in no time at all. It's worth over £1 billion in no time at all. And he's actually suggesting here, and I'm going to play this again because I just can't believe what I'm hearing. He's actually suggesting that moving this way is going to be some sort of antidote to banks' systems crashing and leaving people in trouble and out of pocket. This is madness to me. This is double speak to me. In the old way of doing things regarding banks and high street banks, when things went tits up, at least you could go to the branch on the high street and you could ask for cash, cold, hard, fecking cash, right? You could say, right, the system has gone mad, the cash machine won't work and my online banking won't work. But look, I'm here, it's obviously me, Richie, give me some effing money. With these digital banks, you won't have that comeback. Listen to what this reporter says again about how important it is that some of these guys, like this Northern Rock guy, coming in to take a position at a digital bank is going to be good for everybody. Listen to this.
Of banking expertise, we've seen what happened in recent years with banks' IT systems failing and the broader payment systems problems and what happens, the chaos that ensues as a result. And I think the appointment of someone like Mr. Hoffman, a former Barclaycard chief executive, former Barclays vice chairman, to the...
Oh, it's brilliant. So former guys who worked in standard banks that we would understand as banks. Some of these guys, of course, were responsible for the cowboy tactics and the cavalier behaviour by their banks and their colleagues that led to the absolute disaster, the mortgage problems, all of those issues that we talk about so often on the programme. Now they're getting into digital banking. Monzo's got a million current account holders. It's worth over £1 billion. What does it do? Well, Monzo says that, this is its own website now, that it's a digital mobile-only bank based in the United Kingdom. It claims... It says, we're building a new kind of bank. And I quote, we're building a bank that lives on your smartphone and is built for the way you live today by solving your problems, treating you fairly and being totally transparent. We believe we can make banking better. A bank that lives on your smartphone. And a Sky News reporter is saying it's great that these executives from the old banks are joining up because it will satisfy concerns that the account holders have that things will be okay if there's any glitches, if there's any problems. The answer is, of course, nothing can be okay if there is a digital problem, if there is a computer glitch in a mobile-only bank. Nothing can be okay. Who are the 1 million morons that are moving their current accounts to a digital mobile only bank that says that it will live on your smartphone? Who's doing that? Would you transfer your NatWest account or your Halifax account to these goons? Well, 1 million people have. The share price has gone through the roof and it's a massive story. It is the cashless society being constructed in front of your face. And when everybody is in a digital-only bank, because watch and wait and see how quickly the high street banks decide to move in the same direction. I know they're doing it already. I know I'm not stupid. Banking on your phone, using their apps. If you're a Halifax, NatWest, Lloyd's customer, you've got an app. You can pay with your phone. I know that. Watch how quickly these banks close all of their branches. Watch it happen, dear listener. I'm not fear-mongering here. This is a massive story buried in an avalanche of Brexit and MP harassment stories today. The success of this bank and how it is attracting not only that bank but digital banks, attracting managers of former high street banks coming to work in the mobile banking digital sector. Cashless. Can you not see that? How devastating it is. And the worst part of this is younger folks love this. They love it. They're all about it. It's incredible. Can do it all on my phone. It's amazing. It's amazing. And do you know where this all leads, of course? This leads to the Chinese social crediting system. It really does. You know? No hard cash. When you're not, when you have no access to cash, I get upset thinking about this. It's incredible to me. It's beyond Thunderdome, this, if you want to talk about Mad Max earlier on, where we're going with this setup. £1 billion worth, this particular bank. It's only one of these digital banks. And when they fail, when everybody is on these banks, when they fail, and they don't have to fail as a company, but when there are logistical issues, you can't get money. You can't use money. You can't transfer money. You can't pay with money. Digital bank, imagine, bragging on its website. We are the bank that will live on your smartphone. That is a direct quote. And this guy, Hoffman, is not the only one coming from former building societies and banks to rush to the digital banking sector because it's all part of a plan that was laid out decades ago to take our ability away, to take the ability away from us to pay one another, to use currency. It's a massive story. 12 and a half minutes past the hour. Let's move on. Big story today, that. Right, so Anna Soubry then, the Conservative MP who was football fans, let's call them fans. I don't know if they're hooligans. And I said clearly yesterday, I do not believe they should be moved on, nor do I believe they should be arrested. So don't jump on me at all. I believe passionately in freedom of speech, freedom to assemble. Nothing these guys did yesterday was criminal, in my opinion. They're an annoying bunch of idiots, but that's about the size of it. Now, the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, described the abuse and harassment of MPs outside Parliament as a type of fascism, he called it. And he called for a change of policing policy, right? Right. He said that recent incidents, including Tory MP Anna Soubry being verbally abused yesterday, were intolerable. More than 60 MPs have called on police to improve their response to abusive protesters outside Parliament. So MPs, 60 of them, signed a letter saying they want police to react to what they have called abuse. MPs saying, we're being abused, police have to do something about it. The Metropolitan Police said earlier today they are ready to deal robustly with any instances of criminal harassment. Now, Deputy Assistant Commissioner Lawrence Taylor said the force was continuing to assess whether any crimes had been committed following a third-party report of a public order offence opposite the Houses of Parliament. Lawrence Taylor, Deputy Assistant Commissioner, or LT to his friends, this is what he said speaking to the media today. Shall we hear him? Yes.
Within protest, everybody has a right to protest. Obviously, we know that Brexit will bring out very opposing views. And our role is to make sure that we facilitate people to protest and allow those views and to ensure that we balance the needs of everybody so that they can go about their daily life. That's both members of the public, politicians, as well as the protesters. We are reviewing the footage. We are reviewing the allegations that have been made to us. And we are taking appropriate advice to see if crimes have been committed at this stage.
And if crimes have been committed, then presumably people will be arrested and will end up facing a court at some point.
Well, certainly, if crimes have been committed, we will take the appropriate action. If we need to arrest people, we will do so. And certainly the direction I've given my officers who are deployed at Westminster today and up until the vote on the 15th is that if we are witnessing any offences taking place, my expectation is that those individuals will be arrested at the most appropriate time and that we will intervene for anybody who is prevented from going about their daily business.
And has the police presence, the police profile in and around Parliament changed today, given what happened yesterday?
We have increased our policing presence around Parliament, recognising the contentious issues that we have to police. And I would ask that people who are protesting around Westminster recognise that, of course, they have every right to protest down there, but they recognise and respect other people's views and people who need to go about their jobs, which includes both politicians and our police officers who are out on the ground.
Now, nobody was impeded from going to their job. This is important. It's very important, this, because this is being misreported in the media today. Very sanitized way of saying lies are being told. Now, we'll get to the lies in a minute. Brian Paddock is a retired Metropolitan Police Assistant Commissioner, and he has an office in Westminster. Top policeman. This guy was one of the top policemen in the country. He was. Still got an office at Westminster. He's often in the House of Lords. He told Kay Burley that he heard the entire thing, and he tells Burley that he believes a crime was committed based on what he heard. This is Brian Paddock, retired Met Police Assistant Commissioner.
From what I saw, and bearing in mind my office is right by College Green where these incidents happened, and I heard the aggressive chanting from outside, there was an offence under Section 4 of the Public Order Act that has a power of arrest to it. You only have reasonable cause to suspect that an offence may have been committed in order to exercise that power of arrest, and yet police officers did not make any arrests.
What the feck did Brian Paddock just say there? Did you hear him? Did you hear him? Let's ask Tom Cruise. Tom, did you hear what he said?
No. Could you repeat it? Because I can't believe my fucking ears.
Well, let's hear him again then.
You only have reasonable cause to suspect that an offence may have been committed in order to exercise that power of arrest.
Yeah. You've only got to have reasonable cause to suspect that somebody may have committed an offence and you can arrest them, can basically take custody of them. This is Section 4. Let's hear a bit more about Section 4 of the Public Order Act from former Met Assistant Commissioner Brian Paddock.
So Section 4A of the Public Order Act, which is intentionally causing harassment, alarm or distress, carries a maximum sentence of 6 months in prison. So that's more than a slap on the wrist.
And what needs to be proven in order for that to happen, for that arrest to take place and a successful conviction?
Good question.
What? It's behaviour, it could just be disorderly behaviour that causes the person that the actions are aimed against to feel harassment, to feel alarmed.
So if you feel harassed or feel alarmed by somebody's presence or by somebody singing something about you or saying something about you, if you feel harassed, if you feel threatened, well, then a crime very well may have been committed.
Or to feel distressed, or for any other person who is present to feel harassment, alarm or distress. Now, what, so Section 4A of the...
What that meant there, that last bit, that some other person, is very interesting.
To feel distressed, or for any other person who is present to feel harassment, alarm or distress. Now,
on your behalf. I looked it up. It's on your behalf. So somebody else can be harassed or distressed based on witnessing somebody chanting something about you. So big baldy Irishman here, I could be in the city and it's very unlikely to happen. We're not the BBC at all here. We don't have that sort of traction yet, please God, maybe in 25, 30 years' time. But I might be in town. Somebody might see me and say, I saw him on that BV television thing there. And they might come over and start singing songs about me, like I'm a moron. Richie, you big bally Egypt, you big Nazi and all of that. I'd just laugh and walk on. But a third party could feel harassed on my behalf. Right. And that's enough for a policeman or a policewoman to say there's a suspicion that a crime may have been committed. You see, this really is Orwellian. It's not just a throwaway cliched line by your presenter. Because I do say some of these things very often, and I'm well aware of it. Repetition. But this is how mad it is. You only have to feel harassed by someone in order for it to be suspected as a crime or to be criminal. I feel harassed by those guys. They're singing football chants about Anna Soubry, calling her a Nazi and a liar. I'm harassed by that. Paddock said he believes a crime was committed. The editor of Spiked Online, Brendan O'Neill, was on Sky News today. He's not happy. He's not happy that propositions are being offered that the police should intervene when groups of protesters chant. This truly is fairly scary, and we don't do fear-mongering or fear porn on this show, but they are suggesting today that when Anna Soubry or anybody else is going to work, that protesters, if they sing songs as Anna Soubry is walking past them, not if they grab her now, not if they scream in her face, which is wrong and certainly potentially criminal, but if they just say stuff about Anna Soubry as she is walking on by, MPs are today suggesting that the police intervene. The editor of Spiked Online, Brendan O'Neill, is very worried about that. He explained it to Sky News today.
I'm really worried about the implications of this kind of proposed authoritarian clampdown on protests outside Parliament. The space outside Parliament is one of the most important public spaces in the United Kingdom. It's the place where for centuries people have gathered to demand progressive change, radical change, democratic rights. If we sanitise this area, if we say that only certain people, only lords and politicians and well-educated journalists are allowed in this space, and anyone who sounds too rough or too ugly for our liking will have to be hounded out, I think that will do real serious damage to democracy and to the democratic right to protest and to express your political anger.
How could you disagree with any of that? O'Neill did then go on to say, I won't play the clip, but he did go on to say that at no time was Anna Soubry physically threatened or touched even when she was being followed. And when she was being followed, she wasn't being followed by a load of people screaming at her and shouting at her. There were people making comments to her about the fact that she was elected in a constituency where the majority of people voted to leave. Traitor was said, but she wasn't touched. Very important to point that out. Nor was there any seeming danger that her pathway into her offices would be impeded. So why the lies today? Why are so many commentators saying that Soubry was jostled and intimidated when she clearly wasn't? She went to great pains to tell Sky News and the BBC that she's had this for years. I've come across it. She said she used to be a journalist covering the miners' strike. I'm well used to it. It's the slings and arrows. Why are so many people saying that she was in danger? She wasn't in danger. Nigel Farage, the former UKIP leader, was on Good Morning Britain this morning. Susanna Reid asked him this question.
Do you think it is justifiable free speech to call a representative in Parliament a Nazi?
Will he answer that? Will he give her a direct answer?
Well, as I say, Susanna, you know, double standards here. I've been called that and worse every day for years and no one cared. George Galloway, who's a very controversial anti-establishment politician, was beaten up in the street in West London and not one member of Parliament said a word in his support. Anna Soubry gets called nasty words. There's uproar. I think the truth of it is,
That's an argument for the police to have intervened in those previous cases that you're mentioning. The question is, do you think it's justifiable for, I mean, anybody to shout those words at anybody? Is that free speech? And do you, because you say you don't want to see an overreaction.
No.
Do you think it would be an overreaction if police stepped in when MPs, politicians, representatives are called Nazis?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think that that would further make the public think that there's one rule for politicians and one rule for everybody else. And I think the fact of life is, if you're in elected politics, people will say nasty, abusive things. You have to live with it. What's not acceptable is somebody leaving Parliament and physically being surrounded and perhaps being stopped from going to speak their mind. So we've got to draw a clear distinction between those two things.
And we need to remember that, of course, deranged minds can sometimes act on this kind of febrile atmosphere in the despicable way we saw with Jo Cox, the female politician who was gunned down in the street. I mean, this action, these behaviours, they all have consequence.
Yeah, they do, Piers. And maybe the truth of this is this could have been nipped in the bud a few years ago. But if you allow one side of an argument to abuse people like me, to intimidate people like me, to threaten people like me, and you don't act, it's very difficult when the abuse starts to go to the other side to start reacting without the public saying there's a huge double standard at play.
Yeah, we'll come back to Jo Cox in a minute. What happened there was Farage cleverly navigated or negotiated the conversation away from the excellent question asked by Susanna Reid. Should it be illegal to call somebody a Nazi? The answer to that is, of course, no, it cannot be illegal. It cannot be legislated for. That sort of thing. When somebody is confronted by somebody, or when somebody is confronting somebody else and they are angry with them, they are annoyed with them, and they say, "You're a Nazi." Whether it is right or wrong is an entirely different matter as to whether it is legal or not. It can never be criminalised, nor should it ever be criminalised. You can make an argument that it's wrong, that it's foolish to be shouting Nazi at people like Subra. You're not going to get anything out of her. You're not going to get a conversation with her. You're certainly not going to change her mind. It's a waste of time. And it's idiotic. It maybe shows a weak mind, calling people Nazis all the time. I've used the term Nazi justifiably to describe the conduct and the actions of the Israeli government. Nazis. The UK government arming the Saudi government to blow tens of thousands of Yemenis to pieces. Nazis. That's fair enough. Can't criminalise it. Jo Cox came up quite a few times today. You won't be surprised. Tulip Sadiq, I know, Tulip Sadiq. I never heard of her till today. She's a Labour MP for Hampstead and Kilburn. One of many people today to invoke the name of Jo Cox, who was murdered only a few days before the referendum of 2000 and the June 2016 EU in-out referendum. Of course, there was an awful lot of speculation at the time about the circumstances around the murder of Jo Cox. A lot of unanswered questions about that. A lot of unanswered questions about the man who languishes in prison for that today, whose name, and I've got so many names going around in my head, but I believe his name is Thomas Mayer. Remember his neighbours? Remember the nurse who lived near him saying that there's no way, not in a million years, would he go out of a morning with the intention to shoot and to stab an MP. Do you remember that? All these unanswered questions. But Jo Cox being mentioned many times today. Tulip Sadiq, the Labour MP.
Sticks and stones, he said, may break my bones, but words won't hurt. Can I just remind everyone listening and Stephen that an MP was murdered? It was actually murdered. It wasn't words. She was murdered. Jo Cox, my friend, was murdered by someone who was a right-wing, self-declared, I don't know if he declared himself as a Nazi, but he was a right-winger who basically said that I wanted to kill Jo Cox because she was standing up for staying in the EU. There is a limit at which we need to say that we've put up with abuse for years for politicians, for journalists, for public figures, and then it resulted in someone killing an MP. So whereas people were more dismissive before when I said, oh, someone's insulting me, someone's saying this, and being called snowflake.
What you say is very important. Lots of people have been saying, but just finally, if you were walking through Westminster and I was of a different opinion to you on anything, and I shouted across the street, Tulip, you're a liar! Is that acceptable?
Well, if I had lied about something, I suppose I'd have to accept that.
It's a matter of opinion, isn't it? Well, you know that.
It's not a matter of opinion, Nikki Campbell. It's not a matter of opinion at all. I mean, we could list the massive lies foisted on the British public only in the last 10 to 15 years. Weapons of mass destruction, the Labour Party and George W. Bush. There are so many of them, you know. What about the Liberal Democrats who got the student vote back in 2010 based on a pack of lies about ending tuition fees? Those are just two examples. There are thousands more where people discover they've been duped. Not me, because I don't vote in any of these elections because I expect that nothing will change when the election is over. People are fed up. There is anger. I could go on and on about that. We might talk about it in a minute. Later on this afternoon, my friend and your friend Kay Burley had her bestie Owen Jones on. Are you ready for a festival of lies and virtue signalling? Have a listen. Burley and Jones have become central to this story. Burley, because she's been roundly shouted down while trying to present her afternoon talk, news, whatever, entertainment show, whatever it is, from Parliament Square or from the Green Area. They've given up. They brought her indoors today because it's impossible to hear anything being said, to hear the interviewees, to hear Burley, because of the noise. I suggested yesterday, I stand by my assertion, this was all manufactured. It was always known what would happen when you put these people near the protesters. When I say people, the programmes and their guests, which are mostly MPs and other journalists. It was inevitable that it would descend into the absolute chaos that it has descended into. Manipulated. It's the manufacturing of a story to produce an end result. The end result is legislating for protest and deciding what can and cannot be said, what can and cannot happen, who can and cannot assemble together. That's the desired result. This is the media being complicit with elements of the deep state. I hate saying that. I hate saying deep state. It makes me like a thousand useless shock jocks in America. But you know what I mean by deep state, by the intelligence community. That's what we're getting here. So Kay Burley had Owen Jones on. Listen to how Kay Burley introduces Owen Jones. Listen very carefully to the video. You're going to hear a video. I know it sounds bizarre. We're on the radio, Richie. Yes, we are. You're going to hear a video. You don't need to see it. It's Owen Jones walking to a BBC interview. He is not being physically touched. His pathway is not being impeded, but he is being followed by people who don't like Owen Jones a lot. Now, I don't like Owen Jones. I despise Owen Jones and people like him, and I have very good reasons for despising him. I've elucidated on this in the past. I've talked about it. I've explained in great detail who and what Owen Jones is, so I won't labour that point. He was attempting to get to the BBC, where he was going to do an interview. And people should think about that, you know. Why you've got this handful of chosen ones, five or six of these people that go from one news network to another on a daily basis. Useful fucking idiots. That's all they do, is go from one to the other to play at being the socialist point of view. Owen Jones is a parole pretender. He's no more a socialist than Genghis Khan was. But he's rolled out by the BBC, Sky News and Channel 4 every effing day of the week to put the socialist point of view forward. He's not a socialist. But that doesn't matter. That's who this guy is. He's not intelligent. He's not smart. He wrote a book, and the book is basically other people's ideas recycled and regurgitated as his own. It's worthless. Right? But he's walking to the BBC and he's harassed. And Kate harassed. Kay Burley plays this video in the introduction to this segment. It's very important you listen to this.
Let's get more now on the treatment of MPs and journalists by protesters outside the Palace of Westminster. Met police officers have been briefed to intervene appropriately where they hear or see breaches of the law after more than 50 MPs wrote letters expressing concerns about deteriorating public order. Yesterday, The Guardian columnist Owen Jones shared this video of him being shouted at by protesters.
She kind of giggled there, Kay. I saw this today. I can't show it to you because it's a radio show, but she giggled as she said this. Burley loves this. I demonstrated this yesterday. She found it hysterical when she was up there with Anna Soubry, which, not suggesting Kay Burley is in on any plan to, you know, bring about legislation for people protesting outside Westminster. I'm not going to be daft enough to suggest that. But I think Burley, on some level, knows what's going on. She finds it very funny. She giggles here.
That by protesters.
Because girl.
MPs wrote letters expressing concerns about deteriorating public order. Yesterday, The Guardian columnist Owen Jones shared this video of him being shouted at by protesters.
Yeah, she finds it all very funny. That's, I think, important to note. Let's hear the Owen Jones video. Please listen carefully to it.
You are because a disgrace.
Oh, a disgrace.
You are a disgrace.
Mate, you're wounding
country.
Me. You're
you
wounding
are a
me.
Lying little yeah. snake.
I am wounded. Lying little snake?
You are a lying little
Carry
snake.
On. Ooh.
And let's have a chat.
I'm
why
having a chat. I'm having
a... Why do you support a party that openly... Come on, let's talk about Corbyn and the IRA and Hezbollah.
Oh, this is amusing.
And this is what you're doing?
Measly.
You're a disgrace.
A disgrace?
Feel sorry for your parents raising someone
well,
like you. You are a vile, vicious little bully.
Owen joining us now from central London. Hello to you, Owen. Tell us what was going on yesterday, how you felt at the time.
Right. So what you heard there was it, was all of it. Jones was walking from one building to another. Some guys came to speak to him. One of them asked him to stop and chat with him. The other guy called him a disgrace. The other guy is some... sounds like he's a member of some Zionist group because he was more annoyed with Jones' support of Jeremy Corbyn because of Jeremy Corbyn's alleged support of the IRA and Hezbollah, right? So that's why this guy was annoyed with him. Called him a disgrace, and I think he might have called him scum at some stage. He referenced Jones' parents. Poor Owen, right? Right? I'll explain in a minute. I'm not going to be disingenuous. I'll be honest. I'll try and see this from both sides. What was Owen Jones' response to Kay Burley? Have a listen.
Well, firstly, huge respect and kudos to you. You've been on the receiving end of abuse from this bunch of fascists. I've got massive admiration for you and, you know, the misogyny they've directed
oh,
at you, the
me.
Racism at your colleague Faisal Islam is a disgrace. So kudos for that.
Disgrace and racism and fascism and Faisal Islam. Here we go.
What happened, though, is on my way to an interview at the BBC, I left Westminster Station to walk over to College Green, which is where, obviously, these big set-piece interviews and so on go on, particularly at times of turmoil. And they appeared from nowhere and started, as you can see, haranguing, yelling. Now, what they're trying to do in these situations is try and intimidate. And I might look like a teenager, but I'm not easily intimidated. There's, my friends will gladly tell you, I thought... I would turn it on them. I would, you know, ridicule them, and show how absurd these disgraceful fascists are. They did the same thing to me. I have to say, just before Christmas, I was being interviewed live on air, and they start shouting abuse, which I will not repeat at this time of the day on your news channel, and then again followed me. But this time, I thought, nah, not going to get a little spectacle out of this one. And which is why I recorded a video which obviously ridiculed them.
A video which ridiculed them. Not really. Fascists haranguing. What does Burley say?
What do you think about the police action so far?
Right, about the police action so far. Now, the police were there yesterday. There were two policemen following the men that were following Jones. Very important. You can see it in the video too. Policemen wearing high-vis, yellow, green jackets, whatever. They were there. They were on scene. Nothing was dangerous. Nothing was potentially inflammatory. Nothing was really going to kick off there. These guys don't like Owen Jones because of the bully pulpit that he enjoys in The Guardian, where he can label people as misogynists, as bigots, as homophobes, and he never has to fucking face them. This is the thing, you see. This is what a bully pulpit is. Jones spends these days, along with his momentum pals, trying to destroy people because they don't have his very narrow view of how things and how life should be. He uses his column in The Guardian, and he uses his appearances on the BBC, Sky and Channel 4 to try and destroy people whom he never has to face, except when he crosses the road to get from one broadcasting booth to another. And these guys have the opportunity to say to Jones, well, here we are, these people that you have labelled as misogynistic and homophobic and fascist and Nazi and all the rest of it. You see, what Owen Jones does is, when these people challenge him through the platform of Twitter, Jones blocks them. It's a fascinating thing today. Piers Morgan tweeted Owen Jones and was very critical of Jones because Jones is blaming the... You'll hear in a minute, he blames the newspapers for the rise of the far right in the UK. He's going to blame the newspapers for the rise of the fascistic right in the United Kingdom. Piers Morgan had a go at Jones today. And what was amazing was, underneath Piers Morgan's comments were comments from hundreds of people, some of them public figures, who said, Piers, can you show me what Owen tweeted? I can't read it because he blocked me. And this is what vermin like Jones do. He did it to me. I tweeted him about 2 years ago and suggested that his book was, well, that he had borrowed heavily from the ideas and the books of others. Right? Stopping short of calling him a plagiarist. And I suggested he was a parole pretender, that he wasn't a genuine socialist. And he blocked me. Now, he's not censoring me by blocking me. He's not censoring me by blocking me. Don't get me wrong, I've said this before, and I'm not important. But what he's doing is, he's saying, I can say whatever it is I want about you or yours. I can label you anything from my very prestigious platforms on The Guardian, on Channel 4, on Sky and on the BBC. But you can never get any recompense. You cannot come back to me and challenge me. Nobody gets to fucking challenge me. That's Owen Jones. That's journalism in the 21st century. That's what a bully pulpit is. I've criticised people on this programme and will continue to do so, but will always open the door for them to come on. I've done it 1,000 times with Zionists. Come on. I've criticised your beliefs, your ideology. Come on. Have a go. I'll be nice. Let's do it. Jones is wretched. So Burley asked him about the police. What does Jones say?
It's embarrassing.
It's embarrassing because Jones wants them all arrested. He wants people arrested for standing in groups together in the freezing cold in Westminster and singing, Subri is a Nazi, la 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 la. They have to be arrested, those people, you see.
Embarrassing. I mean, it was odd because I was there at the front of, you know, being surrounded by these various fascists screaming mindless abuse. And the police only turned up.
Fascists. Nothing that happened when Jones was being pursued, nothing demonstrated by his own video clip was fascistic. It was men challenging him, challenging his opinions, challenging his support through his newspaper of a political party they don't particularly like. That's not fascism. That's fucking democracy. Right? Not so nice when you have to go out of your house, your ivory tower, and you have to cross the street and you meet some of the victims of your bullying through your newspaper and through your media appearances. You're not so tough then. Oh, quick, turn the phone on, quick. And I'll go on Sky News and complain about it and ask why the police didn't arrest these guys. Because they weren't doing anything that warranted arresting. You see where we're going with this? How dangerous this is, how dangerous these times are. I'm going to repeat it again, even though I've said it 17 times already. Jones and his ilk want to be able to destroy people. They want to be able to set the agenda, to narrow that down, to inflict upon people their cultural Marxist view of the way the world should be, to identify more and more identity groups, to create more and more and more vulnerable groups that must be protected from people's opinions and people's free speech and people's points of view. And Jones wants to do all of that and be protected from any blowback. And by blowback, I don't mean any physical harm. Nobody should ever touch, nobody should ever physically impede, should ever grab, should ever assault anybody, let alone Owen Jones. But that was not going on yesterday in London. Nobody was grabbing, threatening, or using their own bodies in a threatening manner. They were just having their say. calling Jones scum, saying your parents must be embarrassed having a scumbag like you. Again, it's not something I would say to Jones, given the chance to confront him one-to-one. I wouldn't do that. But you can't legislate for that. Tough shit, Paddy. You use your columns and your media appearances to tell the world how the world should be, to tell people how they should live, to tell them what they should think, what is thinkable and what is unthinkable. That's what you do. Now you're out on the street and some of the people that you've been harassing through your columns, well, they've got you. But they're not going to do anything to you. They just want to have a go at you. Either stand there and be a man and defend the things that you've said, or fuck off. Because there's no place for you in journalism or in public life. What else did he say? You can tell him annoyed.
And the police only turned up and I just thought they were going to drag them away or get rid of them or just stop.
He wanted the police to drag these guys away. Imagine. At no time, by the way, did Owen Jones stand and tell these guys to piss off and leave him alone. Jones has already told Kay Burley that he found it funny and that he thought it was an opportunity to ridicule them, hence he turned on his mobile phone camera. Jones didn't feel sufficiently harassed to stop, to look at the policeman and to then address the guys to say, lads, piss off and leave me alone. Not interested, go away. Didn't do that. Why? Because at no time was he in any danger.
But they just kind of tagged along at the end. And I find it shocking, not least because of the abuse you've been subjected to, Faisal and others have been subjected to. When I've seen at protests, people being nicked for very, very minor things. If they were speaking to the police like this, would they, you know, in any sense, would the police not nick them on the spot? Now, I know the police are under stress. I know they've suffered huge cuts over the last few years. But what on earth is going on if the police can, you know, attempt to harass and intimidate members of parliament, journalists doing their job on the streets of London? It's absurd. And it does seem to be one rule for some and one rule for others.
But they're saying things, they're chanting things and shouting things outside of the Houses of Parliament. They are targeting the media that props up the establishment and the system that is impacting on their daily lives. These are people whose lives are a struggle from the morning they get up until the morning they go to bed. They are disenfranchised people that nobody has ever given a shit about. And all people like Jones have ever done is label them racist and fascist. And these words that pour forth, that he vomits out every time he's on the media. These are people that have been ignored. Their voices have been ignored. Their concerns have been ignored. Their plight has been ignored forever and a day. What is happening? I would suggest that what is happening is these people are starting to finally figure it out. That the media is complicit to the point we've seen with the manufacturing of stories yesterday and the day before. The media is complicit. It is arm in arm with the government or governments of the day, something we have known since we began to understand how things really work. I've known it for years. So these people are angry. They don't know what the hell is going on. They voted to leave the European Union 52-48. They've seen from the day the vote was announced, they've seen the dismantling of that democratic vote to the point where they know that it's not going to happen. They know that the media is complicit in the lies of the state and of the deep state, and they are fed up. But they haven't turned violent. Their songs, the words they use, the language they use is coarse, maybe is crass, is maybe language you might think is unbecoming of people, especially when used directly towards other people. But it's not violent, and it's certainly not criminal. Anything else in this before we move on?
The Brexit Secretary and also the Speaker, amongst others, have said that they are concerned that this could escalate. Do you think that that is a reasonable concern? People, of course, do mention Joe Cox, who was murdered in the lead-up to the referendum vote.
I'm glad you've raised that.
Jones is really glad that she's raised Joe Cox, because this is a wonderful, wonderful open goal for a bit of world-class virtue signalling by the world champion and world record holder of virtue signalling Owen Jones.
Sickening atrocity, one of the lowest points in political modern political history in this country. Look,
and he couldn't give a fuck, Owen Jones, about Joe Cox. You just know that Owen Jones couldn't give a fuck about Joe Cox. Never did, never will. A day after he spent 24 hours on television wailing about how terrible all the fascists are about the murder of Joe Cox, a day after she died, Jones didn't give her a second thought. That's the way of it. I know, I've been surrounded by these people for over 20 years. Couldn't give an arse about Joe Cox or her children.
Modern political history in this country. Look, fascism is on the rise in this country. Joe Cox was murdered by a fascist terrorist 2.5 years ago. What did he say? Death to traitors, freedom for Britain.
So uninterested is Jones in the Joe Cox story that he cannot remember the name of the man convicted of her murder. Thomas Mary. Can't remember it. This is a journalist who writes for The Guardian, appears on Sky News. Can't remember the name of the man who committed one of the most infamous murders in recent times in the UK. Because he couldn't give a shit. It's an opportunity to virtue signal and to move forward this narrow cultural Marxist fascistic agenda that Momentum and Jones and other people like them are progressing with and are managing to progress with it through absolutely no opposition from the UK media. These are mad times.
Another MP, Rosie Cooper, there was an attempt to machete her to death by a fascist terrorist. Far-right terrorist Darren Osborne came to London and rammed his van into Muslims. He said, it came out later, he came to London with the express intention of murdering Jeremy Corbyn and Sadiq Khan, he said, as a bonus, as terrorist supporters. The police say they've foiled repeated far-right plots last year. There are record referrals of far-right extremists taking place at the moment. And the reason I think we need a big, big, long, hard think about what's happening, given the far-right is on the rise, and we've seen far-right terrorists in other countries, like Anders Breivik in Norway in 2011, who murdered dozens of young socialists on the basis they were allies of Muslims and Islamification and all the rest, is that there are elements of the media in this country who have poisoned discourse and are legitimising the far right, enemies of the people, traitors, saboteurs, crush the saboteurs, mutineers. You know, I have huge differences with Anna Seabury, which I won't go into. Obviously, the sickening abuse she was subjected to is a disgrace. And I would note that the likes of The Telegraph and The Mail have slapped her face, amongst others, on the front pages of their newspapers, denouncing them as traitors, mutineers, and all the rest. There has to be an urgent national debate and discussion about the fact that right-wing, far-right violence and terrorism is on the rise, and the sorts of rhetoric they are using are not that different from the sorts of headlines we see on mainstream newspapers.
Jones wants to introduce a censorship to... He wants to impose a form of censorship on the broadsheet and tabloid media in the United Kingdom that would prevent those publications criticising politicians like Subri and who's the other one? There's a Labour politician whose constituency voted almost overwhelmingly to leave, and yet she's banging the Remain drum. It's got to be Yvette Cooper. And Jones would have it outlawed that these newspapers can call people like Anna Soubry a traitor, when Soubry obviously is a traitor, because the people she represents voted overwhelmingly to leave the European Union. And Soubry is one of the leading lights in the attempt to overturn that particular referendum result. Jones says the far right is on the rise in the UK. I have no time for the far right, or for the ideas or the opinions of the far right. Never have had, never will have. What's worse, though, these guys gathering and assembling, blaming everything on the Muslims, which is folly and ridiculous and intellectually redundant and pathetic. What's worse than that? What's worse than that? I'll tell you what's worse than that. People like Owen Jones having people fired from jobs because they don't like gay marriage, or because they don't like gay adoption. people like Owen Jones pushing for legislation for thought crimes. People like Jones suggesting that people who make what he considers to be homophobic comments sent for re-education. People like Owen Jones who thinks it's a fantastic thing for drag queens to read stories to children in kindergartens. What's worse? The shaven-headed, and I've got a big shaven head myself, the shaven-headed, tattooed fuckwit who gives the Zig Heil salute and who blames the Muslim for everything, moron, or Jones, who wants to transform society through the methodology, through the methods I've just described there, and that's only the half of it. Through this gender identity agenda, which is madness. And he'll call somebody like Tommy Robinson a fascist. Robinson is a fascist. He's a goon. But Owen Jones is just as bad as him. And he's like using, as I said before, the bully pulpits to destroy people's lives because of things they said in the past, things they said about women or homosexuality or whatever. These are crazy times. I said this yesterday in the monologue, that this was a manufactured story, a manufactured hysteria, but that what would come out of it would be a discussion about how protest happens, how it should happen, and who gets to control it, and who gets to assent to it, who gets to say, yeah, it's okay to protest. We had this years ago when legislation was introduced around unions and when unions could and couldn't strike and when unions could and could not support other unions. Legislation that meant that doctors couldn't go out on strike in favour of factory workers. Now we have it today. These manufactured events and stories being used to pave the way for a whole new approach to what people can and cannot do to protest the nightmare that their lives have become. The only fascist on national radio and television today is Owen Jones, the prole pretender extraordinaire. No more a socialist, as I said earlier, than Genghis Khan. I'm going to leave you with that and say I'll be back with you tomorrow at the usual time of 5 p.m. Big up to Michael Rivero for coming on the show. It's whatsreallyhappened.com for Michael Rivero. If you've not checked out Mike before, lots to talk about in the next couple of days. The programme will be on podcast real soon and I'll get it on YouTube in a couple of hours as well. Going to close out with The Boss and The Rising, which might be appropriate or might not be. See you tomorrow. Passing